S-A-P-O-O, San Francisco, by my baby!
Shiba Shiba! Shiba Shiba! Shiba Shiba!
Let me in!
Shiba Shiba!
I wanna be closer to you!
Shiba Shiba!
Open up your soul!
Shiba Shiba!
Let me find that part of you! The part that nobody ever knew!
Let me touch your love!
Oh! Why don't you let me in? Let me be the first to ever touch your mind!
Hello and welcome to Let Me Touch Your Mind, the show where we try to get you to be something, do something, experience something, enjoy something. And you know, theater is something that everyone enjoys and it is a labor of love. So when a new theater company is born, an angel gets its wings. And here to talk about a new theater company that's here right in the heart of our own Bay Area, I'd like to welcome the artistic director of Rainbow Zebra Productions, Andrea Gordon. Hello.
Hi, welcome. I'm so excited to be here. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being on the show today. Before we get started, tell us a little bit about Rainbow's Theater, Rainbow Zebra Productions, why it's called that, how it came to be, the works.
Okay, well, it's actually kind of a funny story. When I was a young woman, I was in college at the New School for Social Research in New York, mm-hmm. and I would always take the IRT home. And that's the subway. Mm-hmm. And one day I saw this enormous rainbow-colored zebra that was advertising something, and I wasn't sure what it was, but I just loved the image. I thought it was fantastic. Mm-hmm. And then the next week when I came back for that same evening class, it was gone. They were advertising something else. And I literally thought that picture out my entire life. And, you know, on Facebook, I would look, and now my feed forever has been filled with rainbow things and also zebras. But eventually, I found it, and it was an advertisement for the School of Visual Arts.
Oh.
And they actually had a copy of it that I could purchase. So I purchased a copy of it for myself and for my writing partner, Aiden Stone,
mm-hmm.
and I bought us these posters, and we put them up over both of our desks, and we would be on Zoom, because, you know, this was all during the pandemic,
mm-hmm.
and we were trying to figure out the name for our production company, and I looked up one day and thought, you know what, let's just call it Rainbow Zebra, because it's inspirational to me. The headline on it is, "To be good is not enough when you dream of being great."
I thought that was
a lofty goal. So that's how it ended up being called Rainbow Zebra Productions. And Aiden went on to form his own production company. And I, because I was more focused on theater,
mm-hmm.
started working on different projects. And the first of them was a production that we did at the Magic Theater of a play I wrote called Miriam and Esther Go to the Diamond District, which got wonderful, wonderful reviews.
Mm-hmm.
And because of it, Sean San Jose, whom I've known for many, many years,
mm-hmm.
asked us to become a resident theater company at the Magic Theater.
Oh, very
so
nice.
We're very honored to be part of the Magic Theater at this point.
That's wonderful. And there's so much optimism in being willing to start a theater company in the midst of a pandemic that I can't even...
optimism might be, there might be another world for it, but yes. Especially given the economic climate now and what's been going on with small theater. And there's a caveat to all of this. I'm also obtaining my PhD at the California Institute of Integral Studies, and my area of study is to save small theater in the United States.
Wow. And, you know, the theater since its invention has always been struggling. I mean, you look back, you know, in Shakespearean times, as far back as you can go, you can find theater, small theater companies that are just struggling to stay afloat.
It's a tough thing because, you know, right now in particular, you're in competition with streaming services mm-hmm. and, you know, films that everybody's online. And live theater is its own animal, and you have to get people willing to go to a space and
mm-hmm.
sit cheek by jowl with other people and mm-hmm. breathe in the same air. But there's nothing that beats an incredible theater performance. The audience and the actors and the whole production become one thing, and every single person who goes to any theater production knows this. They have a unique, specific, in-time experience mm-hmm. that cannot be replicated sure. on film or TV.
I was talking to the DJ that's on before me, Charlie Miller, and he said he was going to go see a production tonight, and he said it's a Rainbow Zebra, and I was like, oh, I'm going to talk to them today.
Oh, cool.
So what is the production he's going to see?
That's marvelous.
So what's the production he's going to see tonight? Since it's your
tonight at 7 o'clock, uh-huh. we have a reading of a new play by Michael Lynch, whom I've known for over 40 years. He was the resident playwright at the One Act Theater Company.
Mm.
And it's a play called Book of Glass, and it's about five hitmen and their female boss and their kidnap victim. And it's actually something of a comedy-dramedy.
Okay.
I think people will really relate to it. You know, and it becomes a discussion a lot about feminism and power and violence and the acceptance of violence in our culture. So I think it's a really fascinating play, and he's an incredible playwright, and the actors are just out of this world amazing. So I'm super, super excited for this evening's reading, and it's the first in our whole series. We're going to be doing a reading pretty much every single month until March.
Okay, so is it just once a month, or is it every Monday? How does this work?
These are all different days because of everybody's different availability.
Okay.
But we have the first one is tonight at mm-hmm. 7 o'clock at the Magic Theater, 2 Marina Boulevard, Building D, third floor.
Mm-hmm.
The second one is on the 29th at 7 o'clock. They're all Monday night
okay.
at 7.
Okay.
And the second one is my play that I wrote called My Lunch with Trish, which is an homage to my dinner with Andre,
okay.
except it's two women and it's lunchtime
okay.
and all the conversation that women get involved in. The one after that is Training Wheels by Robin Bradford on October 20th. After that is Leaving Simone by Susan Jackson. That's on November 24th mm-hmm. at 7 o'clock. And then we are going to be bringing back one of the readings from last year, which is an improv-designed piece called A Pickwick Christmas, which was adapted by Brian Lohman. And he's one of the mainstays at Bay Area Theater Sports and has been a brilliant improviser his whole life. And so the play is improvised, so it's
wow.
new every time it's done.
Wow.
And that'll be December 15th at 7. And then we have The Secret Museum by Lynn Kaufman on the 12th of January. We have Drunk at the Base of the Bodhi Tree by Julia Hebert,
uh-huh.
at 7 o'clock on February 9th. And then we have Remember Me, Remember by Lisa Ramirez, which will be on the 23rd of March. And to end the event, we have a screenplay adaptation of a novel called Painting Through the Dark by Gemma Whelan, which I'm super excited about. And I'm actually working on creating crowdfunding for that to become a film set in both Ireland and America. So that'll be the 13th of April at 7 o'clock.
So are all of these readings or staged readings?
The actors don't move around on the stage, but mm-hmm. we get together and rehearse, and we analyze the characters, and we get to the themes of each play. We decide what each play is trying to say, and we want to make it as lively and performative as possible. And the audiences so far have absolutely adored them.
Oh.
We did a full season last year, and I should also say that the goal behind this is to do plays that are written by women primarily, although Michael is our token man this year, who are over the age of 55.
Oh.
So I noticed that there was a very disparate, basically, I haven't seen that many plays or productions that are by, you know, known artists who are over the age of 55. A lot of what we see in film and TV and theater is people who are younger or people that are incredibly well established. Mm. Everybody who's part of the program has to have been either published or produced. So these are not baby playwrights. But that's the criteria, and then whether I like what it's saying. And what I'm trying to do is create an incredibly inclusive, positive world for women over the age of 55 who write.
That is incredible. And for our listening audience who is interested in the whole run, do you have a web presence?
There's a website, which is rainbowzebraproductions.org.
Okay.
And the calendar is there.
Okay.
And it's free. So please come, and these are all professional actors. I'm directing the majority of the pieces.
Mm-hmm.
Lisa Ramirez is actually going to direct her own play, but you know, I've been a director producer in the area for over 40 years at this point. So I'm excited about the project. It's very creative and wonderful for me and everyone involved. It's super cool.
Excellent, excellent. So, for our listening audience who is intrigued by the concept of these readings, what if somebody thinks, oh, this play would be great? How would they go about, you know, getting involved with Rainbow Zebra Productions?
All they have to do is contact me via email. Mm-hmm. My email is easy. It's AndreaG@magictheater.org.
That's Andrea G at Magic at Rainbow. What?
Andrea G at magictheater.org.
Ah, okay, okay. And then one
theater is spelled with an RE, by the way.
You always have to check that out. And then once more for our listening audience, when and what time and what is the name of the show this evening?
This evening we have Book of Glass at 7 p.m. It'll be at the Magic Theater, Fort Mason Center, 2 Marina Boulevard, Building D, 3rd floor. Please come. You will not be, you'll be very surprised and happy that you came. It's a wonderful, wonderful piece.
And they don't have to reserve in advance. They can just show up.
Yes.
Excellent, excellent. Well, Andrea Gordon, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today.
Well, you are wonderful. Thank you for having me. I really, really appreciate the support, all the support that you guys give to the arts in the area. It's really, really profound and important. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, people of Earth, this is your opportunity. Go check it out this evening at the Magic Theater. You will. You can go onto their website and find out more about all of the stuff that's coming up, and you will have your mind touched. Coming up, I've got Carly Ozard, who's going to be talking about her album release. So do stay tuned.
Thank you.
Gosh, I love that song so much. It's Musicas and Atgontotam Eso Esik. I thought it was raining from the Prisoner's Song. You're listening to 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco. Who's about to touch your mind right now? The fabulous chanteuse, Carly Ozard. Welcome.
Hi.
How's it going?
Wonderful. How are you?
I'm doing great. I hear that you are satisfying your public's desire to hear you independently by having an album release party. Is that correct?
Yes, it's very correct. You heard it here. Yes.
All right. Tell me more about it.
Well, I fell in love with musical theater as a kid, and I just have been singing it ever since. And I've met some incredible people along the way that have guided me to learning some really amazing songs from rare musicals, musicals that didn't work out very well, but the songs just lived on in me and a lot of other people who really love Broadway. So tonight at 7 o'clock, the doors open, 7:30 start. We have an incredible live showing of what's on the album.
Ooh, and what is on the album? I love the concept of...
Listeners might know, you know, more familiar shows like South Pacific by Rodgers and Hammerstein or Sweeney Todd by Stephen Sondheim. Those are two musicals featured on this album. We do Pretty Women and we do A Little Priest from Sweeney Todd. Mm. We do A Cockeyed Optimist from South Pacific. And probably another well-known tune on the album is Before the Parade Passes By. From Hello Dolly by Jerry Herman, but arranged by myself, New York composer Bill Zeffiro, and me. We infused it with hints of Before the Parade Passes By. I'm sorry, with hints of Don't Rain on My Parade from Funny Girl.
Ah.
So we have arrangements. We have lesser known songs like Chain of Love from The Grass Harp, Children of the Wind from Rags, Falling Out of Love Can Be Fun from Miss Liberty. That's an Irving Berlin tune. It's about, you know, focusing on really awesome songs by really awesome composers that maybe we don't know right off the top of our heads.
Nice. I do love that you're choosing some things from lesser known or maybe things that maybe died on the vine, but there were still really good songs in them.
Exactly. The best.
So what would you say is your most obscure song that you just love?
That's on there or just in general?
In general.
Obscure song in general. Oy. Well, I am a huge John Bacchino fan, and he's a composer, a musical theater composer and cabaret songwriter. And a lot of his chord progressions and the way he writes, like nobody else writes like him. And so... learning his songs are a universal challenge, but then also victory for everyone who takes it on.
Ah, so like it's a challenge that people really want to take on.
Yeah, his songs really reach people, and I can really only hope that I have at least one of my original tunes that reaches people the way multiple songs of his reach multiple people.
Very cool. Tell me more about the album release party tonight.
Well, my friend Bernadette Bohan, I'm pretty sure your paths have crossed maybe. She's a terrific artist, and she's been running a gallery over in South of Market, and it's called the Greenhouse Gallery. She infuses her love for plants in, she wants to make more, you know, urban and city dwellings nature friendly. So she's got really gorgeous plants everywhere, and butterflies and bees come. Ooh. We have nature happening in SoMa, folks. It's amazing. So her gallery on the outside has wildlife or insects, let's just say, and inside is even more beautiful plants, a gorgeous venue that can be used for multiple things. It's an art therapy healing center for the most part, but it's perfect to have something like this.
Okay. And then what time does it start again?
Tonight the doors open at 7, but the show begins at 7:30, and there's going to be a little intermission, but just to take a break. And you know, there's a bar, and you know, there's going to be a really cozy atmosphere. And yeah, that's pretty much what is going on tonight. We have a really amazing band. We have the former maestro of the Lamplighters, Baker Peoples, at the piano.
Uh-huh.
We have Daniel Fabricant, who is the most incredible bass player. We have Jerry Herrera on cajon, who I've been working with for years, and I just think he's amazing. And then Baker S. Peoples, the son of Baker Peoples, is uh-huh. on violin. And so we have quite the fun layout. We also have special guests singing as well.
Oh, so it's like a Carly and Friends.
That's it.
Excellent. That's it. Excellent. Excellent. So once more for our listening audience, where and what time?
Okay, 7 o'clock our doors. 7:30 is when the show begins,
mm-hmm.
and it's at 864 Folsom Street. Near the Metreon, near downtown,
okay.
near Yerba Buena, all that good stuff.
Okay.
And the gallery itself is called Greenhouse Gallery. It's spelled GRNHS.
Okay.
Greenhouse Gallery.
And can people bring their children, or should they leave them at home?
Yes, children. Oh. Yeah, all ages. That's another great thing about this venue.
Excellent, excellent. And then for our listening audience who maybe wants to follow you and know when and where you're doing things, how can they find you online?
Oh, Carly Ozard Sings is my Instagram and TikTok handle.
Mm-hmm.
And www.carlyozard.com is how you can follow me, and you can get the album through Amazon, Apple, Spotify. It will be available on Bandcamp soon, and it will be available through my website shortly.
And what's the website again?
CarlyOzard.com.
Excellent. Well, CarlyOzard.com. I want to thank you so much for being on the show today, and I hope that the album release is a smashing success.
Thank you so much. I adore you, as always.
Back at you, babe. Okay.
All right.
Listening audience, people of Earth, this is your opportunity. There's so much going on. This is your opportunity. Carly's got an amazing voice, and you're going to hear a little bit of it right now. Because she's a queen enjoyer. Yes, that's Carly Ozard and Ensemble doing a killer queen. You're listening to 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco, and you're in luck because I've got a scintillating scientist in the house to talk about science. So you get a bonus science episode this month. So you're welcome. I'd like to welcome from the Wonderfest crew, science envoy Viraj Manwatkar. Did I get it right?
Yep.
Sweet. Yay. So, Viraj, before we get started about the science, tell me, when did you discover that you were into science?
So, in around sixth grade,
mm-hmm.
I was like in middle school,
mm-hmm.
I vividly recall the moment when one of my neighbors where I used to live,
mm-hmm.
they had a tiny telescope. And he was doing some stargazing, and I looked through it, and I was able to see Saturn and its rings and its moons in its full glory. And that was like, that image is still imprinted in my mind to this day. And that was like, wow, like space is so cool and it's just so vast. And I think that was like the first moment that clicked for me.
And you were how old again? Seven?
I was in sixth grade.
So you're 12.
Yeah, 12, yeah.
Oh, okay.
So that was like, wow, like science is really cool. And then that's what got me started into thinking about science. I read a bunch of books. And then it just follows.
So how did you manage to stay on track in science? Because a lot of kids, you know, you hit your teen years and, you know, most people want to, I don't know, travel with a band or something. But you instead are like, were you still into astronomy at that point or was it just science in general?
I think at that point it was science in general. And all my credit goes to my parents. They gave me a lot of books that I could just spend my time in my room reading, and credit also goes to all the people who wrote the books because they were quite engaging. And I recall reading this book about by Stephen Hawking. It was called A Brief History of Time, and it was this book that explains how time is relative and sort of special relativity and all these awesome concepts. And that was like mind-boggling to me.
Yeah.
Like, so that's what kept me engaged. And then in school, I had the opportunity to take science classes. And then when I went to college as well, I had a broad science interest. I knew physics is something I wanted to do, but specifically astrophysics, astronomy, I did not know was an option until I went to college. And in college, there were we actually had a major in astrophysics and astronomy. And so that sort of was like, oh, this would be a cool thing to do. And I tried it out and I loved it.
Okay. So describe astrophysics to people who barely know what physics is.
Yes. So first, let's start with physics.
Okay.
So physics is essentially the field in which you're trying to make sense of everything around you. For instance, When I talk, there are some vibrations in the air that are traveling to you and you hear me. Or for instance, when you see the sun, why is the sun the way it is? All these different sort of trying to explain everything, the world around us, that is essentially physics. And you can write down mathematical laws or some sort of rules that govern the world around us. And that's sort of physics. And then specifically in physics, what astrophysics is trying to deal with is everything sort of up in space.
Okay.
But turns out we live in space as well. So one could think of astrophysics as the most broadest in sense, trying to understand the universe we live in, how it came to be, how did things like us form in it, and sort of everything in between.
Okay. All right. So astrophysics, how things work in space. So now here, like I just started watching Three Body, the original, not the newer one. So and they were talking about, what is it, the farmer and the turkey scientists and things like that. Is there a way to guarantee that all the stuff that we are familiar with in proximity to the Earth is actually the entirety of space? Because maybe we're just sort of in like a part of where we just have particles of stuff. And maybe if you were in a different part of the universe, there'd be all of this stuff that we've never even, these elements we don't even know about.
That's a great question. I mean, I think like that's the cool thing about science is you really never really know absolute truth. All you have access to is the things we can see or sense with our experiments. And it is very much in the realm of possibility that outside our what we call a visible universe, whack things could be happening.
Okay.
So for instance, people talk about these things like multiverses where there are these other universes like ours out there, but very different. So, but I guess to actually answer your question, the way we like to think about science is like you're getting increasingly close to what truth possibly is. And no single model or single theory is the truth. It's a better description of the world around us. So for instance, thinking to like the 1600s and 1800s, people taught that time was like a constant thing, like time for you, time for me, 1 second is the same. And that's sort of how we came up with our laws of motion, like how bodies move and everything, under that sort of principle that time moves the same for everybody. And in our local universe, like that's pretty much true in our like close to Earth. But then Einstein came along in the 1900s and he had this paradigm shift. Was like, turns out time is not universal for everybody. There's no such thing as an absolute time. A clock for you and a clock for me could be very different depending on where we are in the universe. And for instance, if you're close to a black hole, is this sort of very dense object in the universe, time moves very different for you than time for us. And so this is an example, for instance, how being where we are in the universe influenced our concepts of time and space. But, and so, and then when we came across these like new paradigm shifts brought about by these very, very scientists, our eyes were open to other possibilities of flaws in physics in the universe. And so over time, we get continually better and better understanding of how the world works around us. But it's still our best as a guess at what the universe is.
Okay, so you just mentioned that time moves differently if you're near a black hole. Is it faster? Is it slower? Is it like, what is the difference?
So time will move slower. So if people have seen the movie Interstellar, they give a beautiful description of this whole phenomena. And the idea is that if you're next to a very, if you move very fast, or you're next to a very strong gravitating object like a black hole, time moves slower for you than, let's say, somebody like us sitting on Earth. But here's the awesome thing is that this is all relative. So there's no absolute time scale in sort of, because we're also moving right now. We're moving in space, we're moving in Earth, the Earth's rotating. So it's sort of this, this was a whole paradigm shift. It's like there's no single clock in the universe. We each have our own individual clocks, and it's all relative.
Yeah, I'm still having a difficult time because I think like you and I were having a conversation and everything is moving. So how is it that time would be different, the passage of time would be different? I could see how maybe light would slow down, but I don't see how time could slow down.
Yeah, so to your first part of the question, you know, you and me, we're sitting here, time is ticking for us the same way. It's because one could say we're in the same reference frame. So we're right now essentially moving in the same way in the universe because we're very close to each other. We're all on Earth. Earth's moving in some way in space. So we are essentially in the same frame of reference. We're essentially moving together.
Okay.
And in that sense, clocks are, for us, there's no difference in how our clocks are moving with respect to each other.
Okay.
But an example of how this would not be the case is, let's say you stay where you are.
Okay.
And I just hop out. I hop onto a rocket ship and just zoom very far away, very fast, and zoom back again.
Okay. Okay.
And when I come back, you will be much older than me. I guess like, like sort of relatively.
Sure, sure, sure.
Like I will probably be very similar age and you'll be much older. So that sort of idea is that as I was moving very fast, sort of the speed at which I'm moving in the universe has something to do with how my clock is moving. And this is, the thing is that these are things that we don't experience in our everyday life because human beings, we don't achieve those speeds. So when I say very fast, I'm thinking of like speeds comparison to light.
Sure.
So light is extremely fast.
Okay.
And so we human beings on Earth, we don't ever get close to those speeds. And so we never experience these effects in like an everyday life. And so that's why it's when Einstein proposed this concept for the first time, it was like people were like flabbergasted, like this, we have never experienced this. How does this work? And then, but it sort of mathematically, that sort of just pops out of the fact that if you assume light is this fundamental constant everywhere, then this just sort of follows through. So, but I agree. Like when I first heard of this, I was like, this does not make any sense.
So when Einstein came up with this theory, did people immediately go, oh my gosh, or were there people like, come on now, come on?
I am sure there were people, as always, who were like, this theory does not make any sense.
Yeah.
But the cool thing was that this idea that time is relative just very cleanly followed through some very simple assumptions. Actually, the only assumption was that speed of light is a constant.
Okay.
And this is not a trivial assumption, in the sense that, let's say that I am moving on a car.
Okay.
And then you're on the road somewhere, and I throw a ball at you.
Okay.
If the car is moving really fast, the ball will also move very fast towards you. Because let's say I'm driving towards you and I'm on the car and I throw the ball at you. The ball will move very fast.
Okay.
And if the car, let's say, stationary and I throw the ball with the same speed, it'll be slower.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of, you know, this human experience we have based on living in the world. But that's not the case with light. Let's say I take a flashlight.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of throwing a ball, I'm just shining a flashlight at you. Regardless of how fast I'm moving towards you, the speed of that light that's shining on you stays the same, which is very non-intuitive, because that's not a way experience in everyday life. And so that's sort of this idea that speed of light is constant was shown in other experiments, and it was sort of followed through from some clever thinking on Einstein's part. What does that mean? What are some implications of that? And this sort of a relativity of time idea popped out.
Okay. Does the speed of light, when it gets near a black hole, does it slow down as it starts to enter the black hole?
So what happens is the speed of light itself doesn't change. That's like a fundamental constant in the universe. Everywhere, that's the same.
Mm-hmm.
But what changes is how it moves.
Mm.
So you can think of the universe as like it just has these grids just laid out in the universe. And whenever you have mass or some heavy object like Earth, Sun, we're not that heavy, but, you know, on the cosmic scale heavy, black holes, Earth, Sun, when they are in the universe, they bend this grid around it, this sort of space-time grid, we say.
Yeah, yeah.
And then that causes things to bend along with the grid, because everything is just following the grid. You could think of it like that way. And so light, which is also following this grid, will get bent around massive objects. And so we call that effect lensing. Essentially, if you have an object, light gets influenced by that object, and it curves or it bends. And we call that effect lensing.
Okay.
Quite similar to wine glass. If you take a wine glass and you look through the glass, you see things like warp a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
Essentially the same thing, but not because of gravity. Like, same visual effect, like it's warping, but the wine glass is not doing lensing in like the same way a black hole is doing lensing.
Okay. So I had a very poor science background, so I'm just fascinated by this. So Viraj, tell me about what you're researching right now.
Yes, one of the key questions in the universe or us as humanity is understanding what we're made up of and how we came to be.
Okay.
And part of that, one of the biggest questions is the nature of dark matter. So dark matter is this mysterious component in the universe, and we know it exists. We have lots of evidence for it, but we don't know what it is. And to help answer this question are tiny galaxies, or we call them dwarf galaxies.
Okay.
And so my specific research is trying to find these tiny dwarf galaxies in the universe and studying their properties, trying to understand how they came to be. And hopefully, not just me, but as a field, we can connect those tiny dwarf galaxies to our understanding of dark matter and what it could be.
So how many dwarf galaxies exist to date that you know of?
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's a good question. So that number is continually increasing every day.
Sure.
We're finding more and more. But I would say we know of order millions of dwarf galaxies. There are like a lot of them out there, and continually, as you know, as our instruments, our telescopes get better and better, we have the ability to look farther and farther away and fainter and fainter, and then we just see more of these tiny galaxies everywhere.
Okay, I want to go back in time. So there was a point where people just thought this galaxy was it, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay. And then at some point, someone went, hey, look over there.
Mm-hmm.
When was that?
Ooh.
Like how, like, are we talking just in the 20th century or does it go further back mm-hmm, than that?
Yeah. Oh, I love this piece of history. It's a fun one. So around the early 1900s, there was this debate in the field. It's called the Curtis and Shapley debate.
Mm-hmm.
People were looking up in the sky and they saw these different fluffy cloud thingies up in the sky.
Through the telescope?
Oh, yes. Through like tiny sort of individual telescopes people had built.
Uh-huh.
And they were like, are these things sort of clouds nearby to us? Or are these like extra galactic, as in beyond our neighborhood, beyond our galaxy, far away?
Okay.
And this guy named Edwin Hubble,
mm-hmm.
he in 1929, what he discovers is that he can measure distances now to galaxies. And so if you see this diffuse cloud up in space,
mm-hmm.
you can measure distance to it and figure out, actually, wait, that is quite far away, much farther away than we would have thought our galaxy would be. And so to answer your question, in like the early 1900s is when people began to realize that actually there are these things, that there are other galaxies out there,
mm-hmm.
just like our Milky Way galaxy. There are other clouds, as they used to call them back then, far, far away. But then since then, our instruments, our telescopes have been continually getting better.
Mm-hmm.
And in the late 1900s, people used to have this thing called a photographic plates, where they still mm-hmm. have to manually haul these giant plates to put in front of a telescope to take an image.
Okay.
But then after that, we invented a digital camera, which made it very easy to take lots of photos at one time.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of as technology has progressed, our view of the universe has continually improved and has just shown that the universe is increasingly vast and there's so much out there.
Now, how does the technology improve? Because I remember that there were limitations because of how much the glass would weigh to make the telescopes. Did they have some sort of revolution where they can use lighter materials, or what happened to make it much easier to see further away?
I see. So I'm sure there were many sort of technological revolutions in between, but the one that I know the most about
mm-hmm.
is sort of the transition from using photographic plates, which is sort of like these manual, just like you have to haul these plates up the dome, up the telescope, and put it in front of the telescope to like capture the image essentially. That was like, and then once they transitioned away from that to digital cameras, that essentially allowed that you don't have to haul these massive, huge photographic plates up to the dome with the telescope. Now you have this camera that just sort of on site
mm-hmm.
can capture photons and take an image. And you can take many images very fast, and you can image the whole sky very quickly. And you can also take many images at a specific point
uh-huh.
and sort of stack them to really see faint things in the sky. So I think that was, at least that's most known to me, sort of is the key transition mm-hmm. from like making it easy to image the sky. And this happened in like the late 90s.
See, in my mind, I'm picturing like a dome with just like little phones stuck all over it. But like, what are the size of these digital cameras that are going up there?
Yeah, so there are all sorts of sizes. For instance, these could be of order like a feet or so.
Okay.
But we most recently have this new telescope called the Rubin Space Telescope.
Uh-huh.
And that was recently, it was made at SLAC in the Bay Area. Next to Stanford. And that is a new observatory telescope built that's in Chile. And that camera is the size of a Mini Cooper.
Oh.
So it's like, it's the largest a digital camera ever built.
Wow.
And so it's a full range is what I'm trying to say.
Right. But it's still it seems like it's still smaller than what people had to build in the past, that these massive lenses.
Yeah. I mean, so some of the telescopes back then were also pretty big
mm-hmm.
and some now are even bigger than that. but it's more of like the efficiency. Mm-hmm. Like with that big of a dome, and you can, and that big of, let's say, a mirror, you can do much more than before, essentially.
Okay.
And so it's the size on its own is not conveying, for instance, how efficient or how good the telescope is. Sort of
right.
the instrument itself and how does it capture the image and everything also plays a role.
So like you can have a much smaller thing, but because it's digital, it's like you have like an even huger lens. Is that correct?
Or it's more like, I would say, so let's say if you had we're talking about a camera that's like an order 1 foot, let's just say.
Okay.
And back in the day with photographic plates, essentially what that was is you had this plate that was photosensitive. And so you put it in front of the camera, it takes the light and it imprints an image onto this photosensitive plate. And that's your one image. You take it out, you take a second plate in, that's your second image. And you can imagine,
mm-hmm.
expensive,
yeah.
and also very tedious to keep store. Where would you store all these plates?
Right.
And so with the advent of digital camera, everything was in the digital space. And mm-hmm. you could also much easily take lots of photos very quickly. And so the sheer volume of data and the ability to take images just transitioned.
Okay. So you say that you're out there looking for new galaxies. Have you found any new galaxies?
Ooh, I'm part of this collaboration called DESI, which stands for Dark Energy Spectroscopic Instrument. It's this amazing instrument that's based in Kitt Peak, Arizona.
Okay.
And it is making the largest 3D map of the universe to date.
Okay.
And we recently had a public release of data in like March or so. And in that release of data, we've found around 18 million galaxies.
Just the front door. What?
Who
counts all of those? Do you have does a machine count it? Or like 18 million?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a huge effort by everybody in this collaboration to go from like the raw data the telescope sees all the way to like, that's a galaxy, that's where it is, and those are its properties. Like from that raw image to that sort of statement is a lot of people along the way and lots of hard work. And so it's not me by doing this. It's a whole team. But yeah.
But 18 million, I mean, how do you accurately count that?
It's funny. It's literally a table we have. It's like we load this file and there are 18 million rows in it. That's like there's a galaxy 1, galaxy 2, galaxy 3, and all its properties in this table. And so that's like,
so there's no escaping a spreadsheet, is what you're saying, matter what you do in life.
Yeah. All right.
So do you get to name any of them?
I would run out our names very fast, I feel like. But if there's a special one that, you know, would maybe deserve extra attention, extra name, then maybe we would name it. So actually, it's funny. We have been working on this project where we take some of these galaxies and we do like additional studying of it, additional observations of it. And we found this one galaxy. It was really cool. We call it the superstar because it was really like, it was a very beautiful looking galaxy. And we were like, this is amazing. And we want to study this more. And we just lovingly called it our superstar. So we have named a few like that, I guess.
Well, what made it a beautiful galaxy?
So I guess beauty is subjective, one could say.
Sure,
but
you all agree. This is beautiful. It's a superstar.
Yeah. It is. It's this tiny galaxy. So it's a dwarf galaxy that's in the vicinity of a much larger galaxy like our Milky Way.
Okay.
And it's orbiting this massive galaxy. It's sort of, one could say, it's doing a dance around this galaxy.
Okay.
And in as it's dancing, it has these, it's very sparkly, as in it has these locations, pockets in the galaxy that are intensely forming stars.
Oh,
so lots of new stars are being formed. Uh-huh. It's very bright. It kind of looks like a firework. And it's just like very intensely forming stars, very irregular in shape because it's being influenced by this massive galaxy as it's sort of doing a dance around it. And sort of this, it's a Beautiful in that sense.
Oh, okay, okay. And so when you're looking at these galaxies, because when I look in the sky, I just see like white light, the occasional blue light, but are you actually able to see different spectrums of color within these galaxies?
Yeah. So this, so there are two modes, I would say, in which we astronomers sort of mainly look at the sky. One way is imaging and spectroscopy. Okay. Imaging is sort of like, you know, we take the usual photo. There's like a red channel, a green channel, a blue channel, and we get a color image. That's sort of the imaging. And these, we can have many, many different channels, and we can have many, many different colors like that.
Okay.
Spectroscopy is sort of very similar to that, but you now have very tiny channels. Like you have like, let's say, 1,000 channels or 10,000 different channels of color. So instead of having like a normal image like 3 or 5, you have now 10,000.
Okay.
And so we have both of these data for the superstar.
Okay.
And so I guess to answer your question, yes, we have lots of colors.
Okay.
And we can, it's interesting because each color tells us something different about the galaxy. Like some colors are more important than others. Some colors belong to certain sort of elements.
Okay.
They sort of shine in that specific color.
Okay.
And so we can make an image in many, many different colors to try to tease out these different processes and physical phenomena happening in the galaxy.
So when you're looking at these colors, you'll be like, oh, it's this color, so that must be cadmium, or that must be lead, or you know, whatever else is out there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So universe is predominantly made of hydrogen and helium, and then next in line is oxygen and like nitrogen and all these. And so we do have metals out there, but they're like way less in number than these other elements. And so predominantly when you see a galaxy, you're seeing these lines of like hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, sulfur. These are like the very prominent sort of prominent features. And yes, and so there are specific, we could say, colors or wavelengths of light at which these elements emit light. And so when you look at an image of a galaxy, let's say in like color space, like if you just put all the light and you like see what, how much, how bright it is and what color, there are these peaks you see at certain colors or wavelengths. And those peaks correspond to these very specific elements like hydrogen, oxygen. And so you can study how bright these peaks are, or how bright is this peak or relative to this peak.
Okay.
And that tells you a lot about the galaxy. And so that's sort of what we've been working on as well. And
okay. And then what's something that you have learned or observed or discovered in your work that blew your mind?
Ooh, that's a good question. So I think the thing, I'll say two things. The first thing is not something I've learned from my work specifically, but just in broadly, like being in the field, I've learned is found like matter, like you and me, like in the things we can see and touch and smell, is only 15% of the entire material universe. Like there's this, the other 85% is this thing called as dark matter that we, that doesn't, does not interact with us. It just passes through us. Like right now, it's probably passing through us right now in small quantities, but we would just don't know because it just does not interact very heavily with normal matter.
Okay.
And the thing that's like a, that's to me is quite surprising and shocking. Like just how the sheer unknown in the universe can be scary at times, but also I find that very inspiring. The fact that there's so much in the universe out there that we don't know, and we're all trying very hard to figure it out. So that's sort of, I think, a very fun and I would say shocking thing for me. In my own research, I think what I've been most surprised by is the sheer number of these, as I mentioned, these like millions of galaxies out there. Like just how rapid the technological advancement has gone for us to be able to study these galaxies in such large quantities is like really amazing. And I've been working on sort of assembling these, a catalog of these tiny galaxies. And so I've only just scratched the surface of what we hope to do eventually with this large number of galaxies. But to me, I think the first thing is just like the sheer scale, just the sheer vastness of how many things are out there.
I love that. I bet when you go to like a family function, all the kids gather around you and they just want to pick your brain about everything that's in space.
They do enjoy space.
It's a popular thing. It's a popular thing. Yeah. Well, we are out of time. So if people want to find out more about your research, how would they go about doing that?
They could. So my research lab at Stanford, we have a website. If you look up GFC Stanford, so a GFC stands for Galaxy Formation and Cosmology. So if you look up GFC Stanford, that website, our PI, like our professor, is Risa Wexler. Mm-hmm. And she has a, we as a group have an amazing website where we sort of list all the people working on this research and also a summary of what we do.
Okay.
So if you would like to learn about specifically what we're doing, that's a great place to start.
Okay. Well, Viraj, I want to thank you so much for being on the show
today. Thank you for having me. It was a great pleasure.
All right. People of Earth. Yes, we are on Earth. I'm about to turn the mic over to Mr. Ford, who'll be pleasuring your ear hole. But I'm going to leave you with a little bit of Brain Beats from North Rock 360. This is Trip to Outer Space. Until next week, my friends, ta-ta and toodly-doo.
Take a seat, enjoy the ride. Past the clouds, yeah, we're past the sky. Trip to outer space. A trip to outer space.